Shrink Wrap Radio number 467, How to Step Out of Your Story with Kim Schneiderman, LCSW.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
Today, my guest is licensed clinical social worker Kim Schneiderman, who is author of the 2015 book, Step Out of Your Story, Writing Exercises to Reframe and Transform Your Life. For more information about Kim Schneiderman, please see our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. One of today's sponsors is audible.com, who has more than 180,000 audiobooks and spoken audio products. Get a free audiobook of your choice at www.audibletrial.com/shrink. And before we go to the interview, I want to let all you professionals know that our strategic partner, the Jung Platform, has created CE courses from selected Shrink Wrap Radio interviews on topics such as dreams, relationships, synchronicity, trauma, and more. Go to www.jungplatform.com to see the latest courses. Now, here's today's interview. Kim Schneiderman, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I've been eager to talk to you, so I'm glad that we're finally connected here. Congratulations on your book, Step Out of Your Story, Writing Exercises to Reframe and Transform Your Life.
Thank you so much.
Something to be proud of there. So what inspired you to write Step Out of Your Story?
Well, there are many ways to tell the story, but I suppose it was this sort of like lifelong perspective of seeing my life as a story and myself as sort of the protagonist of that story. Being able to sort of, at times when I was in like challenging circumstances, being able to literally step out of my story and talk to myself in the third person and ask myself, if I were reading this, you know, about the situation in a novel or, you know, if I were watching it, in a film, what would I want to happen in the story? Like, how would I want it to unfold? And that kind of allowed me to kind of, if I were getting, you know, caught up in some sort of, cognitive loop of telling myself the same stories over and over again, I could step out of it and say like, oh, well, I have an opportunity to make a change here and do things differently. How would I want to respond to this situation? So that's kind of the abridged version of what inspired me to write this book.
Yeah. Well, great. And I really resonated to that. You tell the story that as a child, you imagined yourself as a character in a novel. And yes. that particularly resonated with me because I had a similar experience as a child. And I think it may have actually lasted well past childhood. And right. As I got older, it was I had the sense of wanting to be the hero in my own novel, you know, wanting to make sure that I did heroic things, which got me into trouble some of the time, trying to lead an exciting life, I must say. Uh-huh. And also in the book's preface, you share the story of caring for your ill father. Right. And maybe you can share that with us and say something about how that experience contributed to the book.
Sure. Well, the book was already in the works. It was based on a series of writing exercises that I created for workshops in the New York area around the time of the recession. And the idea is that actually, I had read something. It was a mystical book by a scholar of Kabbalah who was actually Kirk Douglas's Kabbalah teacher, and he said that he was interviewing Kirk Douglas, telling him, like, you know, you really when you, I see it, you know, when you play this, when you play a character, you really become that character. And Kirk Douglas said, no, 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 that's actually not true. I always give a lot of love and attention to the characters that I play, but I always have like a sense that I never become the role. I always have a sense that there's a little bit, I can't get too attached to it. And the rabbi who was his teachers went on to say that that's kind of how he looks at life as a soul. You know, he was trying to make the point that we're all sort of souls playing roles, and that when we become too attached to the roles that we play, we can kind of limit ourselves.
Yeah,
like, I'm only this or I'm only that. So looking at that, I was trying to create workshops for people that had lost their jobs, who really define themselves by their job titles, to see that they were souls playing roles, that there's a larger narrative arc to their life.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very successful. But then, what had happened is basically I had a very tough 10 years. My mother died of cancer 10 years ago, after an 11 year, struggle with ovarian cancer. My father had been, you know, and my whole book is about seeing your life as a story. So my father had been the antagonist of my childhood story, and we had started to develop a better relationship after my mother died. But still, it was still a little tense. And when he, 7 years later, and in between that time, actually, he met someone that I really grew to love, and she developed cancer and died. I mean, it was just very sad.
Goodness.
And these are young people too. So it was.
Wow.
It has that element of it too, because, when it became clear that he had terminal cancer and I had to, you know, leave New York to go down to Florida and become his hospice caregiver, I was sort of, and meanwhile, I'm not married. I don't have any kids. And I was really still holding on to this dream that my father would walk me down the aisle. And I had to really ask myself, could I walk my own talk? Did I really believe that I had an opportunity, you know, the power to transform, you know, tragedies into triumph simply by the way that I chose to look at my story or to tell my story? And what I discovered is that I did, but I had to really, I had to read between the lines, because what happened when I was taking care of my dad is that even though it was probably the hardest thing I ever did. And if I told you the things that we did, you would say, wow, you know, that sounds really like a really difficult experience. But underneath all the things that I did that happened in that time was internally between me and my dad, our relationship just flourished and we got to know each other in such a deep way. There was so much healing. And I remember my dad saying like a few weeks before he died that, you know, he was amazed that he was still learning and growing. And I asked him what he was learning, and he said that he had discovered that people had found a way to love him and that he had found a way to love them. And that really stuck with me. And so basically, you know, there's many ways that I could tell this particular story.
Sure.
I could tell it. It could read. I could focus on all the hard things that happened with my dad.
Right.
And I could focus on the fact that I was left, you know, a middle-aged orphan. Or I could focus on the fact that it profoundly changed my relationship, you know, my relationship with him, with men, and was very, you know, healing for me.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of like partly the inspiration, that there's many ways to tell your story, but how you tell your story affects how you feel about your story, which influences how it unfolds.
Yeah, we're going to come back to that theme as well. Before I go on to that area, though, I want to ask about what other influences in your life have oriented you towards story and drama. For example, I read that you've been a journalist. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you've been involved in theater or psychodrama or other things like that.
So I was a journalist, yes. So I began my career. Well, I was an English major, and I don't know. English classes were always my favorite. I was a big reader as a kid.
Me too.
English classes were my favorite.
Me too.
You know,
me too.
And I was, yeah. So I, I, So what struck me about, and then as an adult, I've studied Torah, which is, I guess, what some people call the Old Testament. And it's, you know, and I love the whole process of using your power of interpretation to read into the motives of the characters mm-hmm. and to try and understand them. And what struck me is that one of the techniques that I use in my book is writing exercises in the third person to give yourself some emotional distance. It's kind of like it's in alignment with a narrative concept of therapy concept of externalization. So the idea is, you write about yourself in the third person, it gives you some emotional distance. And I noticed that when people were talking about, we're thinking of a character in a story, but the biblical Jacob or whoever the Gatsby, whoever they're talking about, that they tend to you have to use yourself. It's like sometimes what struck me is it felt like people were actually talking about themselves, but in a disguised way. Because how could you identify with a character unless you had some experience of it yourself? And I thought, well, wouldn't that be interesting to be able to find a way that people could kind of have that distance, but with their own story, not something they were reading in a novel.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned narrative therapy. You're a psychotherapist, and it sounds like you've been influenced by narrative therapy. And, that's an area that I have not really interviewed anybody about or studied much myself. Can you give us a bit of an introduction to narrative therapy?
Well, actually, here's the funny thing. I came up with this idea before I had heard of narrative therapy. I didn't uh-huh. really know what it was. And I was a little scared. I was a little scared about learning about it because I had this idea and I didn't want it to be influenced by anything else.
Uh-huh. Okay.
I was protective of my idea.
Sure.
So after I had come up with this idea and already had a book proposal together, I went to hear David Epstein give for a weekend of David Epstein, who's one of the founders of narrative therapy, present.
What's his name again? How do you spell
David?
David
Epstein.
How do you spell that last name?
I think it's Epston. He and Michael White founded narrative therapy.
Okay.
So I thought to myself, okay, I have this idea already. I just want to find out. I don't want anyone to I don't want to make sure that I'm not that I fleshed out my idea. I want to see if this is narrative therapy or not.
Yeah.
So I went to a weekend in Vermont where he was leading a conference. And what I discovered is that it was not. It was first of all, when I would talk about what I was doing, people were a little bit confused. So I don't think they really completely understood. And that was one sign to me that I wasn't exactly doing narrative therapy. But as I sort of started to become a little familiar with what they were doing, I realized that some of the techniques, like I do everything in the third person narrative. That is a classic narrative therapy technique. So that was very much aligned. Mm-hmm. The idea that the person is not narrative therapy holds that the person is not the problem, right? So the problem is outside of the person. So whatever. I think there's that famous example of sneaky poo and it becomes a thing. And how do you conquer sneaky poo? It was like a kid that had a problem with, I don't remember, I don't do work with children actually, but who was, going to the bathroom all the time and, inappropriately. And, so
okay, that's a new one on me. I've not heard of sneaky poo. I've had four kids, but
okay. It's a very classic narrative therapy story. And they talk about how depression is a thing and when are you able to conquer the depression and when does the depression sneak up on you? So they look for they use the thing and what they try to do is the idea is that you have a dominant narrative, right?
Okay.
And that that's the way that you tell your story and that you omit certain details. And if you focus, they have a whole thing about the culture influences our dominant narrative. So they often work with cross culturally to look at the dominant narratives that, people that define how people, our consciousness and try to then locate the other narratives. Like people, I'm getting a little abstract here, but we all have a particular way that we tell our story and we omit details. We omit certain things, but that if we include it would change how we tell our story. So that is a primary that's all, and that's very aligned with my book too. I mean, that my the way that I go about helping people tell their story is very different than narrative therapy, because it's sort of they have what I guess a number of, again, I'm not an expert in narrative therapy, but different kinds of maps to deal with different kinds of problems.
Okay. Well, I'm definitely
this is more about looking at your life as a story, applying the elements of the story to your own life, to see how the antagonists and the challenges in your story are actually pushing you to grow. I don't think that's narrative therapy, what they're trying to do, right, particularly.
Right, right. Now, your book takes the reader in a structured way through telling their life story, but not their whole life. Why do you ask readers to focus on the current chapter rather than asking them to reframe something that happened in the past or to look at their whole life?
Sure. Because the current chapter is where change is possible. You know, It really is. I think that, you know, sometimes we sort of get stuck in the same old story, and we tend to think that if things have always transpired, in a particular way, that narrative is going to continue endlessly. And that's where we get stuck. The whole idea is that I think people sometimes need frameworks to make meaning of their lives.
Sure.
And so what I've been doing, well, that's basically what I'm doing. I'm providing a framework for people to say, you know, let's just focus on the current chapter. And if your life was a novel, what would be the title of the current chapter? And how would you describe it in the third person? Give me a description. Tell me, you know, who are the supporting characters? Who are the antagonists of your, you know, what are the challenges? And I define antagonists very broadly, because I look at, and I'm using, you know, the story classics, you know, the classic story concepts, to help people sort of, I look at like the antagonist, for example. Every story has a protagonist who's trying to accomplish something, an antagonist that gets in the way, and the tension between those two creates the friction that moves the story along and forces the protagonist of the story to respond and develop tools and insights that he or she does not already possess, because if they did possess them, then whatever would happen in their story wouldn't be a challenge.
Yeah. Now, is an antagonist necessarily a person, or could it also be the job or, you know, some situation?
Yeah, it can be a person, and it can be a situation. Mm-hmm. And it can be, for a lot of people, like their antagonist might be unemployment. It's whatever is pushing you to stretch and grow beyond your own comfort zone. So that could be a negative thing. It could be like getting, you know, people often, especially when they're getting divorced, they're like, it's my spouse. They're,
yes,
my antagonist.
Right.
But it could also be something like, for example, writing a book. You know, the writing this book for like a year and a half, this book has been like one of the big antagonists of my life. It's pushed me to grow in ways that, you know, I really needed to stretch and grow to. And sometimes it's been really hard, but I'm so much the better for it.
Yeah,
so it's whatever is pushing you to stretch and grow in your life.
Mm-hmm.
And looking at that as an opportunity, looking at, instead of the things that, you know, a lot of people, I think when stuff happens, you know, like somebody's diagnosed with a terminal illness, or when things don't go as, when their narrative doesn't unfold the way that they had hoped it would. And often that's, which is true a lot in life, because we have no control over many things. People tend to think, you know, one narrative, one interpretation is that life sucks and it's hard. but if you can look at your life as a story, you can ask yourself, well, if I were reading about, I understand that, you know, conflicts and stories are part of the story structure. We know that things in life are sometimes difficult. And if I can kind of look at the characters that I read about in novels or watch in films, and that those situations that challenge them always help them to grow in a particular way, what if I can look at this thing that's happening to me right now as an opportunity to grow past who I think that I am, into a better, richer, more developed and evolved version of myself? That's the challenge, is being able to get step out of your story in that way.
Yes.
And look at yourself and say, what muscle, you know, like if life is a character development workout, what muscles could I develop here?
Yeah.
Do I need to be more courageous, more resilient? Do I need to open my heart more? Do I need to be more disciplined? And that way, no matter what's happening to you, you can always find a way to grow through it, because it's always pushing you. If it wasn't challenging, it wouldn't be an opportunity to grow.
You know, I think you've already spoken to this, but I'm so in love with the question that I'm going to ask you anyway, and maybe you'll have more to say. How come your book is titled Step Out of Your Story rather than Step Into Your Story? Many therapists work to get their clients to really own their story, their feelings, and so on. However, here you're asking for the reader to step out of their story. What's the rationale for that, and how does one go about doing it? So I think you have been talking about that, but maybe there's more that you can say.
Yeah, for one, like that's such a great question, and no one has asked me that yet.
Good.
And I was kind of waiting for someone to say that, because I thought about it. I thought I was like kind of trying to figure when I was trying to figure out the title, which I had other titles as well. I was thinking, well, is it stepping out or stepping in? But I chose step out because of the emphasis on the third person narrative. I'm giving people, part of this is it's a writing journey, and I'm giving people, you know, an opportunity to use this third person narrative, which actually is not just a gimmick, but is based on a growing body of psychological research. In fact, it was also the subject of a cover story in Psychology Today, the June issue, that shows that when we view ourselves from the perspective of the third person, we tend to view ourselves much more kindly and compassionately. We see ourselves as characters overcoming obstacles, as opposed to the control groups when they've done these studies. You know, they'll ask a series of people to reflect on their lives in the third person versus the first person.
Yeah.
And they find that the first person control group always tends to have more victim stories, where those who are asked these, to reflect on things in the third person tend to look at things like, oh, I had an opportunity to overcome this, or right now, oh yeah, she's facing a challenge that she's trying to figure out what to do with, you know, or it just a little bit more of an optimistic narrative.
Yeah.
And there's been a whole bunch of studies on this. So stepping out reflects the idea of being able to kind of look at your life from an elevated perspective, to get out of the feeling of it, to look at it and look at it from a spiritual perspective. And the thing is, though, at the end of the book, I ask people to step back in. So I do mm-hmm. provide that. Like, there's an exercise where I have them. I say, now that you've, what I do is I walk through people through all of the narrative arc of their story. So I kind of help them identify the beginning, what's the crisis, help them identify their vulnerabilities that are being exposed by the appearance of the conflict in their story, what character strengths might they develop in response, how I ask them to envision how they want the story resolved. I have asked them to give themselves the blessing that they want from their antagonist. There's all these creative dialogues that I use to help them access the voices of courage or the voices of, you know, discipline or whatever voices aren't immediately accessible to them. And at the end, I have them like sort of write an inspiring resolution and identify themes and morals. And at the very end of the book, I have a page from Mad Libs.
Yeah.
And it's like a fill in the blank exercise where you take all of the exercises that you've done in the book and you plug them into like a something that you could basically tack on your refrigerator in the first person, like in the current chapter of my life entitled blank, I am working on blank blank, the antagonist of my story blank is pushing me to develop myself in these ways. So I have people step back in and own it in the first person, because I thought that was really important.
Yeah.
But again, that third person perspective, there was an article again I mentioned in Psychology Today that said that was talking about how we talk to ourselves. And it's not, and they, what they've discovered is that it's not, like talking, not, it's not just, you know, I guess psychology used to believe that, you know, it was just important that we have some sort of self-awareness and talk to ourselves in some way. But what they're finding is that actually talking to yourself, there's a better way to talk to yourself. And that better way is in the third person. And I've even noticed times when I was like in crisis in the past, you know, I remember there was one time I was just like, and I all of a sudden, you know, started talking to myself in the third person. And it got me a little bit, it helped me shift. And
what would that sound like, talking to oneself? If it were out loud, what would that sound like?
It would be like, out loud would be like, Kim. Kim, like, pull yourself together. It would sort of, you know, this is not about you. It would, you know, it's sort of a different, maybe that isn't the third person, but it's sort of like, it's a different voice than like me. Mm-hmm. What am I going to do? Mm-hmm. It's like another voice, the voice of the higher self. Come on, Kim, you know better. This is not right. Come on. Yeah. Maybe the voice, maybe, you know, transactional psychologists might think it's like the voice of the parent, whatever, the higher, the benevolent parent. But it's kind of like it's the voice of the higher self telling me to kind of like not get stuck in whatever emotional thing that I might be stuck into. Yeah. In fact, you know, it's almost aligned with like the idea of the observing mind in meditation, you know, that kind of thing.
Some people call it the witness.
Right. It's the wit. Exactly. So that's what you're doing, right? Okay. So you're tapping into the witness. That's what you're doing. You're the witness is kind of like telling your story, and people, it really changes people who are really stuck. I've noticed when I've done the workshops, it's a subtle shift, but the third person just like frees them to talk about themselves in a way that they couldn't talk about themselves. I call it like the sneaky perspective, because what you're doing is you're fooling the censoring ego into thinking that you're writing about somebody else, but you're actually writing about yourself. So it's like a little trick that you're doing. You're tricking yourself, but it works. I mean, people are just always like, wow, I didn't think that was going to actually work the way it did.
Yeah, I can believe you have to do.
Yeah, you're kind of one of those things you have to do. And it's just to help, you know, one of the subtitles I think that was actually, I originally proposed was something like writing a new chapter when you're stuck in the same old storyline or something like that. I can't remember why that was not chosen. So it's sort of, it's a way of unsticking yourself.
Yeah. I'm hearing a repetitive noise in the background.
It might be, you know, it's New York City and it might be there. Yeah. They're doing construction on the street.
Maybe it's a pile driver or something like that.
I don't know. No, I mean, they're doing something, you know, it's New York City. I tune these things out. I don't even hear them anymore.
Okay. Well, you know, earlier you mentioned something about victim stories, and I was once in a workshop where we were asked to tell our favorite story in which we were a victim. And then after we lovingly told that story, to retell it as if we created the situation. And that was very dramatic for me, just changing position and taking responsibility for what happened. It really changed my orientation towards that event. So I really resonate to what you're saying, that the way we tell our story, the way we tell it to ourselves, mm-hmm. can really make a difference.
Absolutely. That sounds like an amazing exercise, by the way. I'm going to keep that in mind.
It really was a very powerful exercise.
Yeah.
Particularly the way it was set up. It was in a, you know about EST, right? Werner Erhard.
Sure, my parents did EST.
Well, I didn't do EST, but this was a spinoff of EST called Lifespring.
Oh.
And actually, one of my friends wanted me to go. I was so skeptical about that sort of thing that he arranged for me to go as a consultant and to write a report on what I experienced. So I went into it as something of a skeptic, but I was willing to try to really enter into it. And So it's very dramatic because they turn the lights down and there's emotional music. And so it's a whole production that really gets you into it. So, it stuck with me. And actually, that's kind of it. It had the impact on me of really what you're talking about, because later in life, when I found myself in situations that were antagonistic, to use your word, for me, that I realized I could back away a little bit and realize, okay, there are two ways I can tell this story. I can either see it as I'm a victim of this circumstance, or I can embrace it somehow and use it in a way to make it a good story. And that was a powerful life lesson for me, I have to say.
Yeah, I can imagine. You know, it is a powerful, I mean, yes, it's a very powerful life lesson. It's interesting, though, because I had heard that, you know, the Landmark Forum, which is also an evolution of EST.
Right.
I'd heard that they're very into story and how you tell your story. And I was also just the same way about narrative. I felt the same way about Landmark that I did about narrative therapy, where I wanted to make sure I could preserve my idea before. I still haven't done Landmark, but I might want to do it now that I've gotten the book out, book done, because I was trying to preserve the purity of the idea. And not be influenced by other people's ideas.
Sure. So, earlier you said something about reading the text of your life. What does it mean to become a good reader of the text of our lives? And how do we go about doing that?
Yeah. Well, again, it's kind of the same idea that, like, when we read, you know, we were both English majors, so when we read a book, when we're talking about it and analyzing it, you can choose to read it. You know, there's many ways to read the same story, right? Many, you know, if you've ever been in a classroom and they're talking about one story, everybody's, you know, got their hands up and they're talking about it from different perspectives.
Yeah.
So I like to look, you know, like, I look at it like this, every life is an unfolding story. It's a unique, dynamic and unpredictable and potentially heroic story that's open to interpretation, especially our own, right? So there's many ways, if life is an unfolding story, then what happens in our life is the text. Like that's the text of it. Mm-hmm. And we can look at the things that we can read that text. We can look at the things that were presented that show up in our plot line. We can read them as triumphs or tragedies. We can read them, you know, or comedies. There's many ways, you know, it's like the parable of the Buddhist parable of the blind man and the elephant. You know, they all kind of feeling an elephant from different, they're blind and they're feeling it from different perspectives. And they think the trunk is the elephant or the tail is the elephant. So it's sort of like in a similar vein. There's just so many ways. We're constantly, sifting through competing narratives of how to tell our story. And what I try to do is, there's not like one right way to tell it, but there are certainly more constructive and better ways to tell it. So what I try to do is to give people a framework so that they can use their power of interpretation to mine their story mm-hmm. for positive meaning.
Well, that's interesting that you're looking for the positive spin. Now, some people might say, well, you know, that's just an encouraging Pollyannish right. attitude, that's not truthful. Obviously, right. I'm on the same page you are, but what would be your reply to that skeptical person?
That makes sense. You know, we're not trying to whitewash over all the unpleasant and pleasantness of life here. And but the idea of if you look at your life as a journey of personal transformation, then there is room within that story to include the hard things that happen. You know, just like the way I told my story about my father, that, you know, there were tough things that happened in that story. It's the conclusions that we draw about them. Mm-hmm. That's really the power of interpretation. This means this happened, and therefore it means such and such. A lot of people jump to false conclusions, and that's how often depression begins. This happened, it means therefore that this will always happen and nothing will ever change.
Yeah.
That's a very depressing storyline. this mean this happened? And I might look at it like, how did it change me? How did I grow from this? You know, one of the examples I provide in the book is the Wizard of Oz, you know, which is like, there's many ways to tell the Wizard of Oz, the story. You know, you can look at it like, here's Dorothy, and she's unhappy. She has this, like, she's in a farm where people love her, but she doesn't appreciate it. And then, like, this horrible neighbor steals her dog, and she runs away, and she gets hit in the head, and she ends up, you know, killing a witch and then being chased by her sister. And she wants to go home so badly, and she has all these, she almost dies, but then she discovers that she had the power to go home all the time, you know, the whole time. And isn't it sad, tragic that she had to go through all of these horrible things and killing people and being chased by people, you know, when she could have just appreciated where she was? Like, what a waste of time. Someone could read that story that way.
Yeah, an interesting retelling of the story,
right, rather than like what I think most people kind of come to understand is that she went on this journey of transformation, that she needed to, it's kind of like Linda said to her at the end, like, you needed to discover for yourself that you had the power to change your story. You needed to discover it yourself. That's why I didn't tell you. So, you know, I've actually, you know, I'm a psychotherapist, and I think a lot of times people really, I think it's partly cultural that people sort of expect like their lives should be happy all the time. And there are people that have more charmed lives than others, but that's just not life. So when things happen, you know, sometimes people will say, well, life sucks now. This happened, therefore life sucks. And life can suck for you in the moment. It doesn't mean that there's, you know, the whole idea is like, you know, there's the things that happen to us, and then which I call the outer story, and the way we experience them, which is the inner story. And one is not more truthful or more correct than the other. They're both part of the story. And, you know, who's to say what the true story is? But the more that you can include the hard stuff and how it changes you, you know, the more that you'll be able to create a story about your life that, you know, is richer and comes closer to approximating truth.
You know, one of the things I like about what you're doing with this is that it's so non-pathological in its orientation, you know. You're not using a lot of diagnostic categories and so on and making people feel badly about themselves or damaged, but rather kind of providing a template in which one can kind of see their life in a grander scale.
Right. Well, the idea is like looking at like what, I definitely, that was intentional. I mean, it's really like that anyone has the possibility to find their heroic story. And we're not talking about hero with a capital H. We're talking about being able to change your character, which for a lot of people, that means, you know, it can be changing the way that you respond to your child instead of when something happens, instead of screaming at them, taking a breath and trying, you know, catching yourself and taking a pause and seeing that they're upset or they're wherever they are and responding in a different way, or changing the way that you have always been in relationships. You know, maybe you tend to be kind of play the victim in your relationships, or you tend to attract the wrong people. When you can really change something in your character, that to me is heroic. Those are the moments that I celebrate with my clients in therapy. Wow, you really changed your story. And that's what I want people to do to see with my book, that if they can look at, for example, one of the things I do have them look at is like when something challenging happens, when the antagonist, you know, let's say a lot of people have these recurring characters that show up in their story and push their buttons, you know, like the boss, you know, the very authoritarian boss who never appreciates what you're doing, you know, and that might be because you had a very overbearing parent who never really could appreciate your accomplishments, whatever it is. People, to help identify those characters, but to look at what's being triggered. You know, what are the vulnerabilities that are being triggered by these experiences? Is it a tendency to tell yourself that, you know, you're no good, or do you tend to like easily go to fear? And if that's the case, you know, what would be, let's like envision where we want to go from here. Do you want to be the kind of character that always responds to these kinds of situations with fear? Or do you want to be the kind of character that always responds to these situations by being very passive? How would you want, I'd like to be more assertive, actually. I'd like to, if you're reading about this in a story, would you want to see yourself, how would you want to see yourself evolve? Would you want to see the character stand up for themselves or make sure in an assertive way and not an aggressive way? And how would you write that story? And that's what I want to help people do, is be able to see that they can change things in the here and now. And that's kind of like what you were talking about with I think it was called Lifespring. And that's, it sounds to me like that was more focused on the past. But here is an opportunity to look at like how you can take responsibility for changing your story right now, because that's when change is possible.
Yeah. Now this book grew out of the workshops that you were doing, and I'm wondering, do you also apply this set of techniques, ideas, etc., in the individual work that you do?
I do, not as much. Mm-hmm. It's because people come in, you know, I do classic psychotherapy and people come in with the different kind of problems each week. It's not like most people don't come in and they want to consistently follow something. So I'll plug in pieces with people. I'll say, sometimes I'll suggest specific writing exercises to them if I feel like they're stuck in a particular place. Obviously with a book now, it's going to be a lot easier to do that, you know, because it used to be stuff that was in my computer and I'd have to do a printout or send it to them.
Right.
And now I have a book and a large number of my clients have bought it. So I can say, you know what, there's this exercise, check that out. I want you to check these two exercises out and do them. So it's a little bit easier. I've had a couple of writers in my practice who wanted to do this work. And, so I kind of assigned the exercises a little bit more piecemeal. It's during the workshops that people tend to go on more of a journey. Mm-hmm. I did an 8-week workshop at the 92nd Street Y a few years ago, and actually it was those students that were like, this should be a workbook. So
that was an eight week course. How long was each meeting?
Like an hour and a half, I think.
About an hour and a half for 8 meetings.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can see where that would make a very nice workshop.
Yeah, so they were folks zeroing in on the current chapter and looking, because it was like, what's happening to you like right now in your life? And again, a lot of people were going through job transition. So what's happening in your life right now? And, you know, where do you want to go? Where do you see the what's your character arc? Which is something I often ask people, like, what's your character arc here? If you were to stay on the same path that you were staying on right now, where would you end up? And in fact, one of the exercises I give people is to do a character at the beginning is to do a character sketch of themselves. And that way they can get sort of a holographic picture of you know, where of how they're evolving. You know, I ask questions like, you know, who is the protagonist? What does he or she want? What's getting in the way and what's at stake? Which are actually some of the questions that authors will use before they begin writing a novel to flesh out their characters.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea behind that is that, you know, once, you know, if you understand like a little bit more about who is the hero of your story, you know, what he or she is made of and what's driving them, you can kind of get a better sense of where they're headed and whether that is really where they want to go.
So I imagine that, well, I probably should ask you who you had in mind when you were writing the book.
Who I had in mind when I was writing the book.
Who did you write the book for?
In terms of like my audience. And
yes, exactly.
Really, I mean, anybody, I have to say I was thinking of adults because I primarily work with adults.
Mm-hmm.
It was really people who felt stuck. It was for people that were finding that they were stuck in the same old storylines and wanted something that would unstick them and to get a fresh perspective on people who like to write, people who might be a little bit more, holistically oriented. It wasn't like a particular, although it's very interesting because at the end of the book, there's a, people have an opportunity to kind of write what I call like your life story, to look at your life and look at the different decades of your life and assign a title to each of them, describe the main, you know, conflicts mm-hmm. and the main themes and the main growth, learning opportunities and morals of those times. It's like a big chart that they can do. It's kind of like a life inventory.
Yeah, so that's reaching out beyond the current chapter and kind of looking at a broader sweep without having to write your whole life down, which would be overwhelming.
Right, and but some people have told me that, like, who work with the elderly, that they could see that being a really good life like review tool. I also happen, even though it was not meant for people who are writing their memoir, I think this would be an incredible tool for people who are. It wasn't designed that way.
Yeah.
But I can't imagine that, like, by doing this work exercises in this book, that it wouldn't bring up a lot of rich information that you could use in your memoir.
Yeah, that's a good point. What about therapists? Could you see this being a good auxiliary book for therapists to own or to perhaps assign?
Absolutely. In fact, in some of my workshops, I've had therapists and they've bought the book and tell me that they're using it with clients, but periodically. Or at least I just did a book signing in June and one of them was very enthusiastic about it and had written me an email saying she was using it. But I've, in my workshops in the past, like, I've had handouts that people say that they've used, you know, they've borrowed some exercises. Like, so yeah, absolutely. Yes. So I would say that therapists would get a lot out of this and could assign it to their clients.
Okay. Now, going back to the exercises themselves, you described the climax of the story. That seems to be particularly important. And, you see it as being able to give yourself the blessing you want from your antagonist. So tell us a bit about that. We're at the end of the story, the person's looking back, and we're getting near the end of the interview. So this is a good place to kind of talk about that.
Sure. In classic adventure stories, like, you know, the tension between the protagonist and antagonist builds to this, you know, big climax where, you know, the hero generally challenges or destroys the enemy, the monster, or the villain. But, you know, in real life, you know, these climatic confrontations don't involve the destruction of others, but rather, you know, confronting and slaying our inner dragons, you know, to achieve an important outer goal.
Right.
And so what this might look like in real life is, like, maybe we stand up to the bully, or we profess our love for someone, or we have that important conversation, you know, that we've been putting off with our boss or our spouse or our child. So sometimes people have a lot of, you know, they get very attached to what these, like, situations will look like, and it can create a lot of anxiety. And what I was actually having a hard time figuring out how to do this particular exercise, because I could have people look at, like, what's the best case scenario, what's the worst case scenario, and usually something happens somewhere in between. But that felt like it was missing something, because the whole point of this book is to help people feel empowered regardless of what actually happens in their story. Like, that you know. So then I realized that, you know, sometimes I was reminded of the biblical story of Jacob wrestling with the angel, where, you know, there was a time where he asked for a blessing. And this is actually sort of the, mark that he's evolved. So because at the beginning of his story, he was not able to ask his father for a blessing. He had to disguise himself, but here he is, he's wrestling with an angel and he's saying, bless me, bless me. And I thought to myself, you really can't ask for a blessing unless you know that you deserve it. So what if, like, you know, what if you could ask, you know, what if, like, we all want, and whenever we imagine these kind of difficult climatic situations, we all want them to unfold a particular way. Maybe we want the person that we're struggling with to come and see our point of view or validate our choices. But what if you could just give the, what if you knew that you were, you know, what if you were so convinced, so ready and, you know, feeling to step up to the challenge that you knew that no matter what happened, you could walk away feeling like you did your best. What if you knew you deserved a blessing no matter what happened? And that would be kind of like, that would be a successful climax regardless of how things unfolded. So I realized, one of the exercises needed to be able to give yourself the blessing that you're seeking from the antagonist of your story.
Yeah, because really that's what it comes down to, right, is that you're giving yourself that in your imagination,
right,
but you're actually giving yourself that blessing that you seek.
Right. So putting it in real-life terms, I had a client who was getting married, and she was having a lot of problems with her mother. They had had a very enmeshed relationship, and for the first time in her life, she was kind of standing up for herself and doing things in the way that her mother did not understand or approve of. It was very hard for her. And she kept thinking that if she could just explain her rationale to her mother in a particular way, maybe her mother would come to validate her choices and tell her that she was being, you know, she still thought she was a good girl. But her mother was just not there. So I had her, you know, do this exercise and give herself the blessing to herself, because that's what really she wanted. Like, what do you want your mom to say? And I want you to give that to yourself, because that's really what you're struggling with. You're struggling with your own difficulty of accepting that your way is okay, that your way might be different from hers. And it doesn't mean that it's a bad way. It doesn't make you a bad person. It doesn't make you a bad daughter. It just means that you have different ideas, and that's fine. And so I want you, so it's like her work was to basically be able to validate her own choices. So she did this blessing exercise, and she said she found it incredibly helpful.
Yeah, yeah. It makes sense to me, and particularly from thinking of from a Jungian perspective of active imagination and so on, that mm-hmm. That these sort of inner imaginary dialogues, if you will, between different parts of ourselves. This articulates so well your approach with a lot of different theoretical perspectives. Mm-hmm. And I can see this giving the blessing as a, you know, it's could initiate a positive inner movement.
Yeah, absolutely. And I happen to love, I mean, I'm a huge fan of Jung's work, and that's probably the new direction that I want to explore more in that area, and have been, you know, very influenced. I've read, like, you know, articles and stuff, and I think I want to, my intention is to explore that a bit more, because I think my ideas are very much aligned with you.
Yeah. Well, let me encourage you to listen to Shrink Wrap Radio, where I've interviewed quite a few Jungian analysts.
Okay, oh, great, I will, I See, will.
And yeah. So that's a very digestible way to learn a lot of Jungian psychology. I even, a little self-promotion here, I even have CE courses. I have two or three CE courses on Jungian psychology that you can apply towards the CE units mm-hmm. that you need. So as we wind down, is there anything else that you'd like to add that maybe we didn't touch on?
Can I say that I'm not sure when this is airing, but I have a book signing this week in the Bay Area.
In the San Francisco Bay Area. And this will air about 2 weeks from this Thursday. And today is July 27th, so listeners can do some kind of internal math. Maybe do you list where your appearances are on your website?
I do. I have a website called stepoutofyourstory.com, which is where you can actually order the book through Amazon and Barnes & Noble or New World Library, which is my publisher.
Great.
I also have a Facebook page called Step Out of Your Story, which I invite people to like. And I'm going to be doing a workshop in Manhattan at the JCC in Manhattan on October 25th.
Okay, great. Well, I'm sure we've got some listeners in New York. And hey, listener, if you're a New Yorker and you go, be sure to let me know. I'll be interested to hear about it. So, Kim Schneiderman, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
I'm struck by how well Kim Schneiderman's approach dovetails with other psychotherapeutic traditions. It's certainly congruent, I think, with cognitive behavioral therapy, in as much as it indirectly challenges old beliefs and dysfunctional assumptions by inviting the client to step outside their story and to search for a different understanding of it. Her emphasis on finding a positive spin on the storyline also reminds me of certain schools of dream work that advocate, in dealing with nightmares, for example, re-dreaming the dream again in the waking state, but giving the dream a better, non-traumatic ending. In addition, the idea of finding the silver lining in the story fits well with approaches coming out of the positive psychology movement. The idea of extracting a blessing from your antagonist reminds me of the lore about the Senoi, who reportedly instructed their children to confront the monsters in their dream and to demand a gift. And, as I suggested in the interview, I think her approach fits well within the Jungian active imagination tradition. And, of course, the notion of reframing derives from short-term therapies and has been pretty much incorporated into many other therapeutic approaches. So I'm happy to recommend Kim Schneiderman's book to you, whether you be a layperson or a therapist. I do think many therapists will find it useful as an adjunctive assignment, either in whole or in part, for selected clients. Once more, Kim's website is www.stepoutofyourstory.com. And once again, the title of her book is Step Out of Your Story, Writing Exercises to Reframe and Transform Your Life. And as always, you're encouraged to purchase this book using the Amazon widget in the right-hand sidebar at shrinkwrapradio.com.
Hi, Dr. Dave. This is Jim Wagner in Minneapolis, Minnesota. I am just finishing my degree in marriage and family therapy and am happy to contribute to your podcast. Shrink Wrap Radio has been a huge benefit and continues to be a huge benefit to my education. I'm so grateful for the work you're doing. Please continue to keep it up. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you, Jim Wagner. I can't tell you how much the support of therapists such as yourself means to me. It's a real endorsement of this labor of love by fellow professionals. Well, I hope others of you who have the means and have not done so yet will join Jim in helping to financially support this work. Thankfully, we do have 3 new additions to our honor roll of donors. A big thanks goes out to Alice Chapman, Karen Milady, and Mariana Naldi, who you will recognize as our blogger. There are no new transcripts to announce just now. As I mentioned last time, I've put a new listener survey on the site, and it would be really helpful if you would take a minute or two to fill it out. There are only 12 questions. The old one had a lot more than that and was created nearly 10 years ago. So I need to update my understanding of you, my audience. Just go to the survey tab on our site. Thanks to all of you who have ordered our new app. I'm hearing great reports on it. If you've got a smartphone and you'd like to get this app, just go to the apps tab on our site. Once again, we have a new affiliate sponsor, DreamHost. I know some of you must be thinking about having a website or starting a podcast. You can get 1 free domain name registration by clicking on the blinking DreamHost banner in our left-hand sidebar. and then using my special discount code of shrinkwrap on sign out. Be sure to check out the right-hand sidebar on our site where you can use our Amazon widget to order not only books, but any of the things you buy at Amazon. It will help support our efforts here. And also, please take a look at the books that you see listed there in the right-hand sidebar. They're by our guests, and clicking on those links will take you right to the purchase place on Amazon. For example, you'll see The Feeling Brain by Elizabeth Johnston, The Therapeutic Aha by Courtney Armstrong, Reaching Through the Resistance by Alan Abbas, and Reset by Kristen Lee Costa, among others. They pay a small fee to have those ads on our site, and I hope you will reward their faith by clicking on the ads and purchasing a book or two. Finally, for any of you who are not already members of Audible.com, my favorite audiobook service, let me recommend a book for you that I just finished. If you've listened to Shrink Wrap Radio for any length of time, you may have figured out that I'm a longtime fan of Apple Computer. I've been a fan ever since the Apple IIe, and since that time have owned more Macs than I can count. I mean, I suppose I could count them, but let's just say that there have been a lot of them over the years, and I've lost count. And so, of course, as what they call an Apple fanboy, I've also been fascinated by the life of Steve Jobs. As a market research consultant, I even got to run some focus groups for Apple in the early days, and later, during a brainstorming session with Apple execs, I was actually in the room when the young Steve Jobs came into the session to make some observations of his own. And of course, I attended most of the Macworld conventions in San Francisco, including the one where the iPhone was first announced by Steve himself. Well, the book I just finished is titled Becoming Steve Jobs. This is the second major biographical book about Steve. It's not the one by Walter Isaacson, which was the first one to come out, and which was very disappointing to people who actually knew Jobs. The picture painted by the authors of Becoming Steve Jobs, Brent Schlender and Rick Tizzelli, is far more nuanced. Mostly, we've heard about the young Steve Jobs, who could be quite abrupt, angry, dismissive, and sometimes insulting. However, this book highlights the incredible maturation process of this young, long-haired, vegetarian visionary who grew into someone who was able to ignite others with his vision and to inspire them to do the best work of their lives, and in the process create the most successful company in the history of the world. Now, this unabridged book, more than 16 hours of fascinating goodness, can be yours. If you're not already an Audible.com subscriber, you can get this audiobook for free and to keep with no obligation to continue your subscription by going to audibletrial.com/shrink. And as I've mentioned before, if that one's not to your taste, they have over 180,000 other titles for you to choose from.
Hi, this is David Gordon from Norfolk, Virginia, at the IASD Dream Conference, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, David Gordon, whom I met at the International Association for the Study of Dreams Conference some time back. Now let's take a quick dip into the old email bag, and I'll read just one, and it's from longtime listener, supporter, and correspondent, naturopathic Dr. Ralph Wilson, who in part writes, David, I'm updating you on my positive changes after discovering your work. Your description of human-focused psychology made sense to me as being compatible with any religious commitment. That made it easier for me to take time to begin to unlock memories and to put in the sweat equity of pain of change experience that you're letting me do, what Michelle Rosenthal teaches in Change You Choose. I found myself writing a term recently that I haven't seen before, saying that I offer counseling shaped by secular spirituality, that is, religion-friendly and atheist-friendly. The term secular spirituality helps me to give respect to the fact that there are connections or intersections between people that are different from what our cognitive brain can understand. I incorporate methods I learned from Bill O'Hanlon before discovering your podcast. I've got a wealth of approaches that can help others. I'm about to move back to Washington, D.C., and have posted a few comments on the Depth Psychology Forum. I may configure my practice to remain there in Washington, D.C. I have again begun contemplating what Wisdom Day 2016 may be like, and possibly actually holding a live in-person event prior to the Psychotherapy Networker Symposium. Thanks for helping me develop my wisdom. In large part, that is because of the way you share your wisdom. Aloha from here, and that's from Ralph. So it's always good to hear from you, Ralph, and I wish you Godspeed in developing your practice and possibly in mounting Wisdom Day 2016. So I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. In addition to emails, you can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site, and you can leave voicemail on our phone at 415-830-4014, or you can use that app that I spoke about earlier and leave a recording that way. Thanks to today's guest, Kim Schneiderman, LCSW, for sharing her wisdom on the value of stepping out of our story. My next interview will be with University of Chicago psychologist Dr. James Garbarino, and we'll be discussing his book, Listening to Killers, Lessons Learned from My 20 Years as a Psychological Expert Witness in Murder Cases. Well, that's sure to be an interesting one. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
Been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.